Right, good evening, everyone. Good evening and welcome to EG's latest Question Time event. My name's Damien Wilde and I'm editor of EG. It's great to see so many of you here. And it has been quite a year, hasn't it? Much of it led or influenced by politicians and government, it feels like. Whether it's devolution, whether it's take-up and the government property unit and HSBC's activity at Three Glass Wharf, or whether it's the good and often bad elements of political intervention at a local or national level. I'm sure we'll talk about some of that. And the latest political intervention was today's meeting of the government's new Board of Trade here in Bristol, which was somewhat undermined by the only member of that board is Liam Fox, the International Trade Secretary. I'm sure he'll have company soon, but an inauspicious start. Still, anything that keeps the wheels of this industry turning should be welcomed. And if I've learned anything from recent legs of EG's never-ending Question Time tour, that it's been to celebrate victories wherever you can find them. So we'll be doing that. So I'm sure you're all familiar with the Question Time format. You can raise a hand to ask a question or to disagree with the panel. Panel, feel free to disagree with each other as well. That's to be encouraged. Or you can submit questions using Slido. Slido.com and details will appear on the screen here. If you go to the website, slido.com, and enter that hashtag, EGQT, you'll be able to ask questions there. And what you can do is you can like questions to the top, so there's no ducking questions for the panel, and I'll make sure those questions get asked. And also, go onto Twitter and use that hashtag as well to engage. Right, to our panel. On my far right is Julian Harbottle, Director of Development and Head of the Western Region at Savills. Next to him is Liz Dunn, Partner at Burgess Salmon. In the centre is Paul Isaacs, Managing Director of Generator Southwest. Then Elaine McKechnie, Centre Director for Future Space. And closest to me is Nicola Beach, Cabinet Member for Spatial Planning and City Design at Bristol City Council. Right, let's get straight down to questions. Can I start with Drew Nesbitt? Drew, a microphone will find you if you just raise your hand. Thank you.
Is the undersupply of Grade A office stock in Bristol now a crisis for the city rather than just another problem?
So is undersupply now a crisis, Julian?
No, not yet. I think it could become a problem. We know that there are a significant number of requirements out there for Grade A space in the city. There are a number of sites that could come forward for development, but are sort of sitting waiting for something to happen in the short term. I think that Bristol, as a regional centre, is, Bath wouldn't like me saying this, but it's probably always going to be the number one local. It's the capital of the Southwest. We've got all the transport improvements coming with the electrification and so on. People want to be down here. We've seen what's been happening in the wider economy, the wider Bristol market. So I don't see it as a crisis yet. Having said that, Bristol has to compete with Manchester, Birmingham, Leeds and elsewhere. So as a city, we have to make sure that these sites are available, that the developers are there, the funding is there. There is a bit more speculative pipeline coming through the system, talking to my office agency colleagues this afternoon, but it's not a crisis yet, but we certainly need to see some more Grade A space coming through.
Do you have a sense of what would have to happen for it to become a crisis, or what would have to happen to avert that happening?
Well, I think, good question. I think part of it is to do with sites and planning and risk and so on, and the wider economy, of course. You know, at the moment, there is quite a lot of uncertainty out there. But we do know, it's very important, I think, that Bristol is a place where people want to be. You know, people want to come and work here, people want to come and live here. So long as that is out there in the wider context, in general, businesses, I think, will want to look and consider coming down here. But certainly, in terms of within the city, the planning system, enterprise zones, making it easy for developers to come down here, take that risk, particularly on a speculative basis. We haven't seen a huge amount of speculative development for perfectly understandable commercial reasons, but we know the demand is out there, and we need to try and create the environment for that speculative development to come forward.
Okay, thank you. Liz, Drew's question was, is it now a crisis or just another problem?
I think what we've seen is quite a change in the office market over the last 5 years. We've had the whole office to resi development, and certainly in Bristol you've seen a lot of the less good office development turned over to resi or to student housing. As I understand it, there is a lack of space at the moment. There is demand, and actually occupiers are having to go into less good space because actually the new Grade A space isn't there. I think what we risk then is those people who do want to relocate down to Bristol saying, where's the space? As you say, speculative development is difficult. And I mean, we had a lovely new building built for us 5 years ago, but it was built for us and we were ready to occupy it. So I think what you've got to create is a market where there is a quality environment for people to come down to. There's certainty about being able to actually occupy that space. So planning, as you say, is very, very important to that. We're not at the crisis point, but I think we're not far off in terms of actually growing the economy here and continuing to attract people down to the city. I think we're seeing a lot of people moving around. So University of Bristol moving down into the enterprise zone, that's great, but they're here. What we're looking to do is actually attract people from outside the city to start with that very high quality space to actually start to develop the economy, more jobs, more infrastructure, and all that follows with it.
Okay, so not far off, is that months or a small number of years?
Oh, I'm a lawyer, I don't do that sort of thing. It's I sense there's a demand at the moment, and it's like everything, it's like development across this city. You've got to keep it going to keep the interest and to keep people here and to keep people investing. And actually, developers and occupiers, you know, will not wait around for a long time because their business needs are such that they need to find somewhere else to go.
Okay, Nicola, is this just another problem or is it near the top of your intray?
It's pretty high on the list, to be honest with you. I think one of our challenges is, you've already touched on it really, is the office to resi conversions. So we are seeing that. And I mean, this conversation, I noticed there's not many questions on student housing, but as anyone that's operating in the city will be aware, that is a huge challenge for us and it is very lucrative. The consequence of that affects normal residential schemes and it also affects key worker homes, it affects the office building as well. I think the key thing for us really is, you mentioned the point about the university. Well, firstly, I have to say nothing in Bristol or any city happens in months, so I think we don't need to worry about that. Crisis happening in a matter of months. But I think in terms of the impacts of the university, they are already here, but they are not at the bottom of that hill. And I think that, you know, only time will tell what the impact of that is. But we've had regular meetings with them. I met them on Tuesday, and they are absolutely good in for it. They've had their public consultation. They're getting on. You know, they want that scheme to be built out, and they see some real consequential benefits of that development coming forward in that area. So I'd say watch this space with that.
Damien, it's just worth... Oh, sorry, my mic's off.
Julian.
I've got on my list, courtesy of my agency colleagues, 14 current Grade A requirements across the city at the moment. So that shows the demand is there. So just as an aside.
Okay, and availability...
I knew you were going to ask me that. Sorry, I have to come back to you on that.
not quite that.
No,
not quite enough
no,
to
no,
satisfy.
No. Correct.
No. Yeah. Okay. And Elaine, you're dealing with smaller, faster growing science and tech businesses. Is it a break on their demand, space availability? Sorry, break on their growth, rather.
I do look at this with slightly different glasses on, I think, to a lot of you guys here. The companies I work with are small, growing, fast growing, high risk. They don't look for top quality office space. They look for low cost, flexible, low risk, community based places where you've got multi occupancy places. And I'm part of an organisation that runs innovation centres all over the UK, and the vast majority of them are not in Grade A office space. Now, I'm not saying that it's not relevant to much bigger companies, but the kind of the smaller end, the tech, the fast-growing ones, actually don't need Grade A. They might get there one day, but that's not top of their agenda. And I think there are a lot of buildings out there that can be refurbished and repurposed into something that's actually really quite exciting. It doesn't really matter what it looks like. Our head office is probably the ugliest office in Oxford, but it's got a fantastic community within it. So I think being creative with buildings rather than just looking at glass walls and air conditioning is worth doing.
Okay, and Paul, you're a residential developer, but are you drawn to cities that don't have the space to grow their business base, as sounds like could be the risk within Bristol? Does that make it a less attractive opportunity for you?
No, I don't think so. I think Bristol does have the space, and Bristol does have the planning consent. So it's interesting, Julian's 14 interested parties. We all know that the major occupiers take considerable amounts of time to make decisions on either relocations or moving offices. And those decisions affect commercial decisions about building speculative office schemes, which is high risk. I think what's been interesting is looking around some of the commercial developers who were looking, 12, 18 months ago to apply for change of use on their office schemes and have now reverted back to, no, we're going to stick with our office consent and we're going to start looking at it. And it's mainly the funds, to be fair, because they're the only people who will build speculatively. I think the problem that Bristol's going to face is secondary office market. It's gone because it's all been converted. And then it's the qualification of Grade A space. If it's, I don't know what the floor plates are for, but if it's 100,000 square foot floor plates, there's only certain key occupiers that will take that sort of space. Try and find me a 25, 30,000 square foot purpose-built office space in Bristol. You can't find those. And that's taken out the middle companies to me that are exactly the people that will be locating in Bristol. For us, residential in the city is the subject that's already been talked about. Great place to live, great place to work, great culture. It ticks all the boxes.
Okay, thank you. Is Elaine Doherty here? Elaine has a overlapping question.
So what can we do to regenerate some of the sites that just seem to exist in Bristol without any development at all? We've all talked about how people want to live and work here, but there are key sites, and the one I was thinking of when I raised my question was the old courts at the bottom of Baldwin Street that just seem to sit there forever, and nothing is done with them.
Nicola, what can we do to bring those back into use?
Well, I mean, it's probably worth a mention that in the last 2 years, the development... Oh, she's not looking. There we go. Hi. Just answering your question. The development has changed. The development pace has stepped up completely. I take your point about that whole area around Castle Park, and actually the challenge we have as owners of the ambulance station is actually we need policy compliant schemes. That's the bottom line. And that tension it's a healthy tension, but that tension is not going to go away. So if there's buildings in the city centre that the Bristol City Council own, we cannot bend. We're a Labour authority with a Labour mayor. We need policy compliant schemes. I mean, it's blindingly obvious.
And those that are coming forward aren't compliant.
No, but that takes time to achieve. You know, it's that whole thing, Marvin says it, Paul Smith says it, I say it, there's no point having the development sector in one corner of a room and the council in the other corner of a room, and they're just screaming at each other about policy compliance and affordable homes. It just doesn't work. We don't want that, but this negotiation takes time. So if it's owned by us, that's part of the reason. But we are moving at pace. That's all I'd say. The scheme's coming forwards, and we spoke about a couple of them on the panel earlier on before we launched onto the stage. In terms of the other schemes, I mean, get involved in the local plan, get involved in the city centre movement strategy. You know, as a council, we're doing what we can. We have challenges where schemes are consented, they're not built, take Bedminster Green. We've got plenty of schemes down there that have been consented, they're at height. We now have other schemes coming forward equally or if a greater height. And the challenge there is actually managing that community expectation, because there's a consent in place, not built out, and people are using that as a yardstick. So this conflict arises. I take your point, but I think it's a really, really challenging environment, and it's as in any city, and it's a mixed bag, and there's not one clear solution, that's what I'd say.
And is it true of commercial space as well as residential space?
Let's take the area around Temple Meads. I mean, it's absolutely crying out for obviously. And I think we, as a council, we're working really hard with WECA now to actually look at how we bring that site forward. It is obviously of strategic importance to the entire region, and we know that. Now, if we can secure a capital investment into that area to give that a kick up the backside, then fantastic. That's what we want to do. I think I think there are key buildings in commercial space as well. I would take that. But at the moment, I think that our greater challenges in residential. I appreciate that's not the core audience, but I'd say that is our challenge.
We are going to come on to residential. Yeah. I was interested in the commercial aspects. Liz, as well, in terms of that city centre regeneration of spaces for commercial use, do you think enough is being done?
I think we've seen some movement. I think we've seen some movement on some key sites, the post office building obviously being one of those. And I think that over the last 5 years, We've seen the City Council being able to be more confident about its approach to actually unlocking development where it had opportunities to. I see that as being a very positive thing. I think the HCA's intervention down in the enterprise zone in terms of actually putting in infrastructure and starting to bring those projects forward, that element of kind of responsibility and strategic intervention, if I call it, from government, be it local government, regional government, national government, in terms of some of those sites, I think is critical. I don't think you can leave it to the market, because it sits with a developer who decides that actually they've got no interest in bringing this site forward. So I think you've got to have those partnerships between councils and between developers to start to bring those things forward. I hope we see more of it, because I think actually it has been the thing that's unlocked, as I say, a couple of those. And the issues around the enterprise zone. I mean, we're on the edge of the enterprise zone, putting that in there, actually starting to be proactive around development down there, putting infrastructure in, those sorts of things, I think actually make a huge difference and start to mean that Bristol sites can compete against other areas where perhaps people are thinking of investing, and bring them higher up the chain. You've got to have good planning, and you've got to have planning that delivers as part of that as well, though.
Okay, Julian, what do your clients say? Do they see blockers to redeveloping some of those sites?
No, I they don't. I mean, some of these brownfield sites, you know, it takes time for things to happen. We know that. I've worked in Bristol for 15 years. I don't live in Bristol. Bristol has been transformed over that time. If you look at Cabot Circus, Finsel's Reach, all the stuff that's going on, there's still a hell of a lot to go at, and we know that. A bunch of sites coming through, and Redcliffe Quay and St Mary Le Port and so on. They will come forward, but they take time. And, you know, we have to deal with economic cycles, we have to deal with different changes of political climate in the city, which is, you know, happens the country over. But I don't see, there are some sites, of course, that have been sitting around for a long time, we know that, but you'll find them in any city. I think in general, if you look at what's happened over the last 15 years or so in the city, you know, Bristol should be very proud of what it's achieved. You know, and with the university, for example, we've spoken about the enterprise zone going down into, you know, the back of Temple Meads down there. That's going to be a proper driver to get stuff going down there again. So, you know, these things will come forward in time. You know, sometimes it's land ownership, sometimes it's funding. There's all sorts of reasons why these things don't come forward. But I don't think the city's got anything to be ashamed about as to what's happened over the last decade or 15 years.
That site was delivered through a city council intervention, yeah. A specific intervention. Yeah. That building had been there for however long it had, deteriorating. There were plans to try and regenerate it and actually try and build out. There was a planning permission to kind of to on it, but there were also thoughts around actually could you keep the building and do something with it. And it was eventually the City Council's intervention in buying that building that has unlocked it and actually meant that it can come forward.
But that in turn brings pressures for future administrations in terms of funding and money and all the rest of it. And, you know, so I suppose it's where your priorities lie, you know. But I do agree with you.
But ultimately that was a commercial deal.
Correct, it was. I don't dispute that. And without it, it wouldn't have brought and been the catalyst for the university. So I do accept that.
And Nicola, is there still an interventionist appetite?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we own quite a lot ourselves already, to be fair, I think. But wholesale purchase of land assembly is not necessarily our immediate priority. But I think what we're doing in our commercial property arm of the City Council in the place, what was the place directorate, I should say, absolutely just looking at how we assemble our land and how we look at bringing it forward in portfolio, just looking for different models to bring that land forward at pace. And it is a challenge. It does take time, you're absolutely right. It does take an intervention, but we have to be straightforward. Anyone that lives within the administrative boundary or ever reads the paper, we have a lot of challenges. There's no two ways about it. But it is on there. It's pretty high up that list. And, you know, we're really excited about what the university have got in store.
OK, enterprise zone was mentioned. Samuel Lewis has a question on that. Just down here in the centre.
Given the successes of the enterprise zone in Bristol, should it be expanded?
Nicola?
Well, it already has been expanded, obviously, in April this year, and now includes Where's Finsel's Reach? There we go. It's I'm all for it's expanding. Marvin's on board with that as well. It's not our decision. You know, we can lobby government. We've got a lot of work to do. We're also not a top-tier authority anymore, and that's something that everyone should bear in mind. You know, we have got a very good relationship with Tim Bowles at Weka. We're working very hard with him. We are the capital of the West of England, you could argue. Well, we are. But it's not as straightforward as what you're saying. I think we have appetite for that. We see the potential in that part of the city. There's absolutely no two ways about
it. For further expansion.
But that is not simply, it's simply not our decision. You know, we're lobbying for that. It's something we would encourage. We want to see that area built out. So let's see what we can do. But if that's what you think, if that's what you guys think, then get in touch with Marvin. Drop him an email. You know, have a voice as a business community. Make that statement because it all helps. He's got 100 things to do. So if this is something that you all believe, then go for it and drop him that name.
Do you all believe it? Who would support further expansion of the enterprise zone? Raise your hand.
There you go. How many of you have contacted Marvin to tell him that?
That's good.
There we are.
So I didn't even look along the line, but there were hands that way as well. Elaine, is that something that you're... do those incentives help the businesses you deal with grow quicker?
Yeah, I had a conversation with a business quite recently about enterprise zones, and they went, oh, I don't really get it. Like, what's it all about? Doesn't it mean I get a discount on my rates? You know, from a business's point of view, and again, I am looking at this in a slightly polarised view because I'm looking at very, very small companies, but they see it as something on the news. They don't necessarily engage with it. So I think the more we can do to raise the profile of what it is, how it can bring benefit to them, and the rest of it is great. But actually, my understanding is the benefits is it brings people together. People in that kind of middle tier, the other key stakeholders, the people that are actually driving this forward, and creating a platform for those organisations to have debates and conversations. And yes, of course, it will filter down to the businesses, but they don't always really associate with what that means for them, in my experience anyway.
Okay, let's move on to residential now. We've got a lot of topics to get through, and that's top of the Slido chart here. Bristol is one of the fastest growing cities in terms of house prices. What's driving the stellar growth, and is it expected to continue in the coming year? Paul?
Supply and demand and planning. Marvin's, you know, he's
just to be clear, that's too much demand and not enough supply.
Yeah, and Marvin made a big, manifesto pledge to deliver 2,000 new homes a year, 800 of those affordable.
2020.
It wasn't a
year. Oh, I've small clarification. Carry on.
Okay. And the planning
system. You can
system,
relax now.
Yeah, no, the planning system is not helping that process. And I am in regular dialogue with Marvin because I have planning applications going through the system that are taking too long. And it doesn't matter whether it's property or any other commodity. If demand is outstripping supply, that leads to price increases. So I operate in different parts of the country. Of the areas that we operate in, Bristol is definitely the strongest selling market for my business. And that is because we are competing
against... In terms of anywhere in the country that you operate?
I've got stuff in East Anglia. Our sales rate there is nowhere near as high as it is here. We can't build quick enough in Bristol because there is just such an acute shortage.
And planning is a major...
Planning is a big part of that. Planning is taking too long. It's on Marvin's list. He's trying to make changes. It's a slow process, and it's taking too long, and it comes back to the question about the properties that are just sitting there. Politics needs to work faster.
So if you had a magic wand, specifically, what would you change?
I'd take politics out of planning. I was at the housing conference last week, and the housing minister said the model's broken and it needs fixing. Excellent. We all know that, and the white paper doesn't fix it. So,
are you in contact with the housing minister as well now?
I'm trying, yeah. He didn't retweet my tweet, but the SME market historically has had a significant
role to play in the delivery of housing. And you know, through effectively the last two recessions, the SME home builder market is a fraction of what it was. And it's difficult because planning is more expensive, it's taking longer, so it's harder for an SME to actually make these things work. The big boys, the nationals, they can't double production. They might be able to increase production, but they can't. They certainly can't double it. So you come back to where is the problem? People say land supply. We don't really have a problem securing land, and Bristol actually has a lot of sites. Funding, I'm quite fortunate. I'm hedge fund backed, not cheap money, but we do have the firepower. But when I spend 3.5 years on my last planning application in Bristol getting consent, and the current one will hopefully be done in 12 months, but certainly not within 13 weeks, that all needs to speed up so that you can actually get these things to site. Once we've got planning consent, then we have the issue is, are there enough people out there to actually build them? And then you go into the skill shortage.
Okay, so but planning consent for now. Liz, there was a wave of noise through the room as a removing politics from planning was suggested there. If that's unrealistic, if I'm reading the reaction right, are there other things that could be done to speed up the process? Or would you support Paul's suggestion there?
Planning is a as everybody in this room knows, is a difficult process. And it's a difficult process because it involves so many different people who've got so many competing interests. So we live in a society now that requires engagement, it requires public consultation, it requires all those things. And very often, planning is the focus of all of those things coming together. So it's politics, what are the objectives of a particular political party in terms of what they're delivering. I used to do a lot of work in the renewable energy sector. That was marvellous 5 years ago. Not anymore. Government decided they didn't like it anymore. So there we are, whole industry grind to a halt. Housing's now flavour. Housing is now flavour of the month because we've decided there's a need for housing. But actually, those political messages around housing are not necessarily feeding down to the local level because it's difficult, because it's very hard to meet the needs of developers and councils and the public and bring all those things together. So there isn't a magic answer to it. There could be better process. We get very bogged down in detail. We get very bogged down in what ifs rather than let's just move these projects forward. We swing between let's have clarity, let's have SIL, so everybody knows exactly what it is they're going to be playing. Let's have SIL charging schedules, and then we move completely the other way, and it's all about no, it all has to be done on a site basis. So I think there's a lot of things have been tried, and there is never going to be an answer to this. But one of the key things that needs to be done is local authorities need to be properly resourced with good planning officers to actually have the ability to be able to deal with projects on a timely basis, deal with the issues they need to, and then be able to issue recommendations and decisions in a timely way. If that involves increasing planning fees, maybe that's the way it has to be, or it's developers actually saying, I will put in place a planning performance agreement because it means I will get... But there is a big issue around skills in local and resourcing in local authority planning at the moment, and I don't think Bristol is alone with issues on that side. And that's really where the logjam sits.
OK. Julian, do you think your clients would be happy to pay higher planning application fees for an improved service?
Well, I think so. And I think, you know, to be fair to the City Council and most local authorities under-resourced at the moment, you know, who'd be a planner? I mean, a nightmare job, I would have thought, trying to deal with all the, you know, all the pressures they're under. And that's sort of at a human level. I mean, I think you have to, you know, the Bristol housing market pulls absolutely right, supply and demand, you know. Bristol's a cool place, people want to be down here, and we're not delivering enough houses. And planning probably is the root cause of that. Whether the ins and outs of that, probably is the fact that that there's not enough coming through the system. But, you know, we I think most developers would be prepared to I think, you know, if it helped speed up the process, would be prepared to pay more to try and expedite that if they could. And at the end of the day, it probably serves the purposes of all parties involved, no question about it, because we need more homes, we know that. We need more offices, we know that, you know, for this city, and anything that can speed up that decision. It is not just Bristol's planning team, it's everywhere. I've historically done a lot of work in South Wales. Generally, planning's a lot quicker down there, in my experience. But it's not such a popular place to be. And so it's in a hot market like this, in a hot city like Bristol, you have to think about decisions carefully and what you're doing. I understand that. So, but if we can speed up planning, it will make a hell of a difference.
Okay, Paul, would you be willing to pay more and how much more?
We actually have a planning performance agreement on one of our sites, and it's made no difference at all. But yes, the principle, we haven't got a problem with that. And it's not actually the quality of the officers, and certainly in Bristol, the officers that we deal with, we think there's an excellent team down here. But they are significantly under-resourced. And then it doesn't help when they've done their job professionally, diligently, tirelessly, and it goes to committee with a recommendation where the politicians then go against that professionalism.
So it's not the planners, it's the politicians?
Yeah, because it's being made by a committee who are more concerned about where their next vote's coming from rather than what their planning team that we all pay for through our taxes are actually advising them. And, you know, I have a perfect case where I've had to take my scheme to appeal. I've won my appeal. I've won costs against the council. It should never have happened. It should have been approved on the basis of the work the officers had done.
Okay, Nicola, I think we should bring you in.
Why not?
Shall we remove politics from planning? Would that help?
Well, I've got a question first. Paul, do you think you should consider a career change? I'm just throwing it out there, because what you're describing is planning, is development, is house building. This is what the world is like. This is what building things in the UK looks like. So I hate to say it, but it is what it is. You know. And I have to also add, if you've got so many problems with your schemes in the city, have you considered that perhaps you're the problem?
It's great.
We have to ask the question.
You do.
Know? It's a debate.
We don't only operate in Bristol and the South West. We operate in different parts of the country. And
I'm joking, sorry.
No, it's fine. As I say, we think the planning team, you know, case officer wise, fantastic down here. It's the cavern that exists between officers and members is what needs to be addressed. And I don't have the answer for that. Either it gets removed completely and you go to some form of hierarchical system as if it was a business that everything gets escalated up to a board to approve things who are actually qualified to make that decision, or there has to be some education of members regarding the decisions they're making and the basis they're making them. What is the point of going through this process for members to then go against all the work that's done and then to lose at appeal? So the fact that I'm winning the appeal says to me, no, it's not me. And I absolutely accept that is planning. But I can tell you, if I go to Birmingham, it's a far easier journey.
You might not find yourself in there. It's a dump. I didn't say that. I did not say that.
Nicola, you didn't
answer...
Sorry,
carry on. I didn't answer your question.
Go on.
What was it again?
Would the system be better served by removing politics from planning?
Absolutely not.
Why?
Because we are the fabric of the city. We're duly elected. We are the city. You know, you take it or leave it. That's the bottom line. You know, we are elected to represent this city. We are the city. We live in the city. We represent those residents, those people that when you're long gone, they're going to be living there. And those people that move into those houses, they're then our electorate. You're talking la-la land. This is bonkers. No, absolutely not. Politics is dead central in planning. And either get on or get out. That's it. I'm sorry. It is what it is.
So the system's unimprovable?
I'm not saying it's unimprovable. Everything...
How can it be improved?
More upfront dialogue. We've obviously going through our local plan refresh. Get involved. Come and talk to us. Have your say. The question about who's contacted Marvin about the enterprise zone, no one puts their hand up. Get involved. That's what all I can say. I'm not saying it's perfect. Nothing's perfect. We're in a changing environment. The fixed term council obviously helps. You know, that's been a huge step forward for the city and for all cities where they've got a fixed electoral cycle. You know, I absolutely support that. It makes complete sense. So you have the certainty. You know our agenda. You know where we're coming from and you know what we want to do. So don't dick us around. That's it.
And
that's my answer on that. I don't know what else you want me to say, really.
to use your phrase, you feel dicked around by too many developers.
Sometimes, yeah. But I mean, I don't sit on DC committee. I haven't sat on DC committee. It plays a very important statutory role. I'm the cabinet member for strategic planning. I don't get involved in these individual plan applications, but I do know the members you're referring to, and they're good people. They want the right thing for their communities. And if they feel they're being dicked around, they have a democratic right, a statutory right, to find reasons why that's the case. And if they find those reasons, then it is an appeal situation, which we don't want either. You know, we don't want that. But let's have those conversations sooner.
And again, to borrow your earlier phrase and to turn around something that Paul said earlier, if he's winning at appeal, do you wonder whether it's you, not him? You, the politicians?
It might be, but it is what it is. You know, we want to work together. It's a statutory service. You know, we work with our planning officers. We work very close. I mean, I don't sit on planning. I can't make that abundantly clearer. But at the end of the day, it is a democratic system that we live in. And all I can suggest is that you actually find that common ground. Look for that common ground. It's that whole thing. You're on that side. The DC committee's on that side. It's an ugly mess to think that it has to go to appeal. Let's find some common ground.
So
as I said earlier
dialogue.
You know who we are, and you know where we are, and you know what we're going to do, and we're until 2020. I mean, there we are.
Okay. Any comments or questions out there on this?
Fire away.
There's a hand that's gone up there, and then we'll come down to the front.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, in respect of the National Planning Policy Framework, which was introduced in 2012, how much of an impact does sustainability have on development for residential build? Because there's this magic phrase about golden thread in terms of how much does development impact the environment, and what's the benefit of that development?
Okay, thank you. Liz, is that coming through in what your clients are asking you to consider, the sustainability aspect?
I think we saw a move with the introduction of the National Planning Policy Framework that kind of captured something that had been happening around sustainability, and I think particularly in terms of residential, a move to trying to make houses more energy efficient and those sorts of things. My view is that we've gone back quite a few steps in terms of that, in terms of what the government is expecting at the national policy level, in terms of particularly things around energy efficiency in homes and sustainability in that sense. So the National Planning Policy Framework is an interesting document. It's one of those things that you can kind of move around to support where you want to be, and I think it has gone through a bit of a movement in terms of what that meant in terms of sustainability and arguably what it means now and how important that is on the agenda. So I think it's still there. I'm not sure it's quite the buzzword and quite the driver that it was 3-4 years ago.
Clearly not the most discussed aspect of it anyway. And sorry, question at the front, and then I'll come further back.
Just to come back on the offices point, if you bring us a site, we'll build speculatively. We always have done that as a business. I see no reason. The point that nobody made is that fundamentally a lot of these sites have the wrong business plan. They have got planning consent for offices which are too large for the market. Therefore, they can't get the investment to build speculatively. Just coming on to the point about planning offices, I don't think we cherish planning offices enough. You know, what's the average planning office paid? About £45,000 a year. And they're looking at schemes maybe £300 million of value. They should be earning £90,000 a year and be at the centre of every development, in my view. And I'm just, for our business, would gladly pay more to allow Bristol to go out and recruit the very best planning consultants that the city needs. The Olympic Delivery Authority did that in London, went out and recruited people, paid them a lot of money. Bristol needs to do that, and I think our business would be very much supportive of that, whether it's funded through the HCA or something. And the last thing, there's obviously bit of tension here, but as a business, we believe in engagement with people, and I would never make a planning application unless I knew I was going to get consent. Never do it. It's a waste of money. Don't try and push water uphill.
Okay, thank you. And a question further there, back there, and while the microphone's making its way there. Nicola, is there political support for better paid planning officers, perhaps funded more through from the private sector, through higher fees?
If you want to sign a cheque for us to employ better people, I mean, we have some fantastic people. I mean, like you say, what you're talking about is something which, on principle, of course, we would support that. You know, we want the best possible team and the properly resourced team. I think that's the thing, is that our guys, they work their socks off, as you say. You know, they could jump into the private sector in a heartbeat. Who wouldn't snap them up? Come on, they've got the system, you know, they understand the system back to front. The bottom line is, though, we absolutely cherish those people. We need them in our business, and I would be happy if there was a mechanism in which they could get some pro bono support or there was some sort of element. And Marvin, the city office up on the second floor at City Hall, I don't know if any of you have been there, come on in. You know, we're there. We've got KPMG working for us on a pro bono basis, giving us support on our city plan. There is that. The door is open. We have people working with us. But it's a challenge because they're always going to be stretched. You know, I don't know many planning authorities that aren't stretched. Again, this is not a Bristol problem. It's a systemic issue across the local development scene.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, my name's Kev Draper. I'm a small to medium-sized property developer. I'd just like to kind of come in on this politics and the planning department. Hi. I'll just give you my own example that's happening right now. 6 months ago, my latest development's proposal in St. George, which is conversion of a lovely Victorian old factory into 26 apartments, was given outline planning permission. 6 months later, the current case officer has also minded to give consent. However, up comes Councillor Craig Asher, and has called this to committee based on two flawed points. One, the vacant building credit, and it's already been agreed it's legitimate and a government incentive. And secondly, the possibility of noise. And even on the form, it says to councillors, you cannot bring this to the committee based on construction noise. And it just seems to me as though this is a potential two-month delay. If it gets turned down the committee, it then goes to appeal. When you've already had two senior case officers look at it and say, yep, this looks a great conversion to take this traffic congestion, this huge factory in the middle of a residential site. It's a no-brainer that it's ripe for a brownfield conversion. And yet you've got politics coming in, undermining your really good and under-sourced planning department and the officers. They're doing a great job, as you say, but having politics undermining this process is slowing everything down. And as somebody quite rightly said, small to medium developers, we live on fresh air while this long, long cycle goes round and there's no income coming in.
Okay, so Nicola, not no politics, but perhaps less politics.
Well, I'm not sure we've met before, but I represent St George Central, so I'm very familiar with your scheme. Probably an interesting approach to stakeholder engagement. Maybe we should have a conversation outside of this, by all means. I know your case inside and out, to be honest with you. I've been lobbied quite hard by the community against it. It's the former porn studio, isn't it? Yes, it's the cluster flats, isn't it? Oh, it's Olympus House. Sorry, my mistake. You're next to the porn studio. It's all going on in St George, let me tell you. Let's talk outside this then, because Olympus House, my mistake.
Okay, without going into the specifics of that case though, what about less politics, where you have your universally highly regarded planning officers making a recommendation and politicians overruling that? Should that be more the exception?
I think we're confusing two things here, because Councillor Craig is actually the ward councillor for the area that we're talking about. This is not a DC environment that you're referring to. This is the ward councillor representing her constituents, and I'm not going to comment on that. I'm still struggling on the same point. Less politics is a statutory process. You know, it's the DC committee, as Gavin says. You know what you're going into when you enter into the room, and it's it's a I take your point. You know, I spent many years working in property PR. I understand the challenges of working with the planning committee. Don't get me wrong. But I think I'm not going to support less politics and development. No way.
I'm only looking for emphatic answers. So. We could talk about residential all night, but we've got some other topics to get through. So let's go to transport and infrastructure. This question here, infrastructure, particularly transport, even with a metro bus, lags behind other cities. Poor transport cannot be attractive to investors. What's the plan, or what should be the plan, Julian?
Well, we've got the metro bus coming through. I mean, Bristol's always had a bit of a reputation for poor transport infrastructure and being a struggle to get around the city. No different to Bath, no different to London. I mean, I know the tubes in London and so on, but all places are congested. Actually, I don't think we're that badly off. If you look at, depending on the time of day, I grant you, but actually from here now, we're 20 minutes from the airport. It's just outside the city, down where it is over there somewhere. The M32 comes slap bang into the middle of the city. We've got Temple Meads, we've got Parkway. So I don't personally think, I'm more half full than half empty in terms of our transport system in the city. I forgot what the original question was, if I'm honest, Damien, having dribbled on a bit.
I'm adapting the question.
Sorry.
So what should be the plan for delivering transport infrastructure that doesn't lag behind other cities? But you're saying that there doesn't need to be one?
Well, I think there's always room for improvement. Clearly, the metro bus, I think, will make a big difference. There are things going on. The Link Road, relief road to the south of the city has made a big difference, no question about that. Although some cynics might say it's just going to become another snarl-up as time goes on. But it's revolutionised, you know, your journeys out to the south. Like I said, I think it's very easy to knock and very easy to say that it's all a complete disaster. I don't believe that it is. I think the metro bus it'll be interesting to see how it goes. There's all sorts of talk about the Southern Relief Road coming down, you know, junction 18 near the M4 into South Gloucestershire and joining together, and that will, you know, to come off the M4 at peak time and get around the west, the east and south of Bristol is quite tricky, no question about that. But I don't know, I'm not a transport planner. In general, the more roads you build, the more traffic and congestion you tend to end up with. So, you know, I don't know.
And there is a statement in here, poor transport cannot be attractive to investors. Is that something you hear said of Bristol?
No, it isn't. And I think the market and the economy and the way the city's been going over the last decade or so proves that. People want to be here.
Elaine?
Yeah, I was nodding, actually. I'm fairly new to the city, and I'm in the north of the city, so I cannot wait for the metro bus to arrive, because... I wonder whether it actually helps some of those previous debates about residential as well, because I think the more connected the hinterland of Bristol is into the city, the kind of bigger the city feels anyway. You know, we can make the most of some of those peripheral areas. I'm lucky. I'm on the UWE campus, so I'm kind of very well connected into the main motorways. I think there are some key things that could happen, but you look at the projects that are happening and you think, let them settle in and start, and then work out how those things are going to change and where the bottlenecks are next, because there will always be bottlenecks, there will always be roadworks, there will always be stuff happening, and I think every city has that. I'd be sitting here arguing that more public transport infrastructure is important, but also other technologies. I wouldn't be right sitting here without flying the flag for driverless vehicles and the future technologies for transport as well. Let's not just rely on cars and transport, public transport. So I feel it's going in a good way. I think it's going to have a very positive impact. And I having come from Oxford, which is also horrendous, by the way, I think every city has it, personally.
Okay, let's go through a couple of other topics quickly, and let's move on to a question on Slido on retail. What are the immediate challenges facing Bristol's retail sector, Liz?
I was really hoping I wasn't going to get this question. Oh, thank you. Julian's given me some notes. marvellous. Thank you very much. I will read them when I put my glasses on. I think Bristol, I'm going to just talk completely off the top of my head as somebody who lives in Bristol and has been here for quite a long time. I think Bristol's got a really interesting retail sector. I think it's quite varied. I think we've done very well on the independent side of things. I love places like Stokes Croft. I love the fact that you can drive down there and it's completely different. We've also got mainstream retail, so we've got Cabot Circus and we've got Cribbs Causeway, so we've got some sort of destination shopping, if that's what people are after. I always find it very sad when one of those things goes up and then nobody ever wants to go to Broadmead anymore. I find Broadmead one of the saddest places still that you can possibly go to, and some bits of it are just tragic. I don't know what you do about that, because it was built at a particular time. Regenerating kind of old shops I don't think is very interesting to people. They want to build new shops with shiny things and things that go like that. So, sorry, this is a very off-the-cuff answer. Was there anything sensible on here, Julian?
Go, Julian, you can have that.
Do you think Julian? Perhaps
yeah.
Julian.
Can I have my notes back?
As long as you don't read from it.
No, well, I'm not, as you can guess, a retail specialist, but I did consult my colleagues. I mean, I am going to have a quick look at this. They've said there are a few bullet points here. Firstly, general uncertainty over Brexit. We haven't been there, but yeah. They are longer-term concerns over suburban centres. Continue to be viable, may evolve into smaller convenience centres. Challenges could be opportunity for alternative uses for excess stock. The internet, of course, big challenge. Transport, when Bristol has a fully integrated transport system, the accessibility to the city centre will improve. But I think in general, I'm with you. I mean, years ago when I moved down to the West Country in 2003, if I wanted to go shopping living near Malmesbury, I'd jump to my car and drove to Cribbs Causeway. You could get there in half an hour, one-stop shop. John Lewis, M&S, happy days. Actually now, we'll come into Cabot Circus and walk up Park Street. For me, I'm a punter here, I'm not an expert. I think actually that, there's a really interesting diverse offer, and I ride my bike a lot into Bristol to and from work. Great way of getting around the city, I might say, if you're into that sort of thing. But actually you're right, coming through Stokes Croft and around there, places I wouldn't normally dream of going to, but some really interesting local, well, no, but I mean, I don't mean that in a nasty way. But there's lots of interesting places to visit and buy stuff. So I didn't mean it like that. It came out really good. I love Stokes Croft.
And Paul, does Bristol's retail sector feel challenged to you, which seems to be behind the question?
I think retail is challenged generally, not just Bristol. The market's changing, and I don't know about other people. I mean, I do 90% of my Christmas shopping online. It's just a different world. And I remember we delivered John Lewis and Waitrose to Ipswich, and they've been trying to get into Ipswich for over 10 years. And one of the members had a go at me because it was going to be the death of the high street. And I said, well, rather than it being the death of the high street, why don't you think about all the people who are now going to come to that location because it's John Lewis and Waitrose, and do something about the high street and turn it into a positive? But retail has got to change, and I don't know where retail's going. In 20 years, will we even have shops? I think Bristol's offering is great because I like the diversity. I like the fact that you can go to the multis at Cabot Circus, or you can go to the independents, and I think that is one of the great things of Bristol. It still has the independent shops and the independent operators.
It's one of the reasons I moved here. Being frank, retail is important to me as a punter and as a resident, and I think it's great. You don't get many cities that have got the breadth of independent shops, and yes, they're dotted around, and yes, they're not in Broadmead, and maybe that's part of the. That part of the solution is trying to encourage some of those independent shops that give a different flavour, bring that Bristol vibe into Broadmead. Maybe that's part of the solution, I don't know. But again, I'm not an expert, I'm just an expert in shopping. Quite like that.
Okay, if digital is one of the biggest threats to the high street, perhaps let's take a couple of digital questions. Joe Morrison. So the microphone's just coming.
So, as Bristol is a leading digital city, How do you see new technologies such as AR, augmented reality, and VR, virtual reality, impacting the real estate sector now and in the future?
Elaine?
I saw your question before we started, and I wondered what you meant by it. Do you mean in terms of how we represent the commercial offering, or do you mean, I couldn't quite understand how you saw that technology being used.
That's my question to you. So there's multiple technologies, not specifically that was an example. Mm. So we have multiple technologies. We're living in a time which is both, I don't know, it's material advancement and technological advancement, which you're in yourself, together with connectivity, is changing radically the way that we think, or we should be thinking, or you should be thinking, about space and about place. And when we're talking here largely about placemaking, when you're talking about retail and residential and so forth, and why people want to be in a city, well, digital technologies are implicated directly, both in terms of the way that we experience, but also increasingly in the way that we operate. So I'm just wondering, how are digital technologies, how are you thinking around digital technologies within planning, within building, within retail, and so on and so forth, in order to benefit Bristol, considering we are a digital city? Mm. We're, Huawei said in a report said that other than London, we're the leading digital city in the UK. So how is that affecting regeneration? How is that affecting the real estate sector?
I think you could break that down into so many different topics, and we could probably have a whole different event on that specifically.
We do, actually.
Okay, great. Weeks, so. I'll be there. I'll bring some of my pals. There's lots of places to start. It wouldn't be right without arguing the point for important infrastructure, digital infrastructure, internet infrastructure. You know, whatever we're installing now is not going to be good enough in 5 years' time. We're on a kind of, you know, one of those sorts of curves, and we have to be forward-thinking and making sure that infrastructure is right for, 20, 30, 50 years' time. So that's kind of point one. But the bit that resonates with me the most there is actually a slightly different flavour, and that's around the ageing population. And I know you might think she's going off on a curveball here, but we've also got squeezes in the NHS. But people are living longer, but they're probably living with ailments for longer as well. They're not able to be self-sufficient in their homes in quite the same way. And one thing that I think the technology sector is really adding value to at the moment is helping to keep people in their homes for longer in a safer way, reducing the impact on the care sector and the NHS, and making a better quality of life for those individuals. And I think, you know, there are some quite big care organisations that are looking at how you introduce technologies retrospectively. But actually, I don't want to get back onto housing, by the way, but if we're talking about future-proofing housing for the long term, making sure that those houses are designed in a way that are going to be fit for purpose for the way that the technologies are moving on, and that people have got higher expectations about what they are going to be staying in that house that they buy when they're 30 or 40 or 50 or however old they can afford their first house. We need to make sure that those are designed in a way that can be adapted to accommodate that sort of technology. We've got some great interesting companies sitting within what I do that are really going to change people's lives in terms of the way they live within their homes and reduce that reliance on the care sector. So, but I know that's a very kind of niche part of your question there, and I don't know if it's completely answered. It's probably not. But
well, it's purposefully a wide question, and there are multiple perspectives. So yours is absolutely valued, and thank you for that. So yes, I'd love to hear
I'll
other
get some
people.
Other perspective. We have overrun, but none of you have walked out, so I'm just going to run it for a few more minutes. And James Prowse had a question as well, which, sorry, back down the front, which I think I'd like all the panel's views on how technology is changing their area of business and the sector more widely.
So James Prowse from HyperOptic, and it's related really to the question that preceded. So what changes will the Internet of Things bring to the construction and operation of residential developments in Bristol? It might be residential or commercial businesses, but it's going to change the way we build stuff and operate it.
Okay, Liz, you were dying to come in on this.
I think it's a very interesting time, and it's very interesting bringing fast-moving digital with more slow-moving, having to build houses and roads and all those things, and actually how, as we were talking, how you future-proof those things. I think there's some really interesting stuff around our roads. So what are we doing about electric vehicles? What are we doing about driverless cars? How can we make sure that actually the roads, the investment that we're making in the future, allows for that sort of technology to come forward? I am so excited about the fact that you might get chips put into rubbish bins that tell you when they need to be emptied, so that actually there's a way of managing things like rubbish. Don't get me started on rubbish. And actually the things that matter to people in terms of the way that they go around in their day-to-day kind of moving around the city, that actually we can manage that more remotely. We can build better cities and better environments for people in terms of the way that we manage them by actually harnessing those digital technologies. And I think you're moving there into the kind of smart city, future city sort of agenda, which is very, very exciting. The challenge is that some of that's still out there. Some of it's very tangible, and we sort of start to understand it. It's a bit like when people got very excited about district heating schemes. It seemed like such a no-brainer, let's start to put district heating in. And everybody went, oh, yeah, but we've actually got all these houses, we've got the infrastructure. It's very difficult to retrofit that stuff. So you need to be thinking ahead, but it is very challenging when perhaps the technology isn't quite as tangible as it might be now, and we're not quite sure about what we're going to need in order to future-proof.
Julian.
Well, I'm not going to lie. This is one of the questions I feared the most coming here this evening, because I wasn't sure what the Internet of Things was, if I'm honest, but I did Google it this afternoon. And I think it's all to do with discussing...
But take the topic more broadly, then. AR and VR and...
Yeah, again, I wasn't quite sure what they were either, Damien, to be honest. So in terms of the impact of technology and so on residential development, I mean, it's clearly going to become more significant. I mean, I still find it extraordinary that I can turn the thermostat up on my home 25 miles away now on my phone if I wanted to, and so on. It's the way it's going. Certainly our clients who are at the want to be at the forefront of this by and large, particularly the small SME type developers, because it can make a development more distinctive, but differentiate from the competition and so on. I had breakfast this morning with a chap called Jonathan Brecknell, who runs Urban Creation in Bristol. He does student kit and open market resi and so on as well. And he was enthusing about these things he's bringing in that I don't understand, if I'm honest, but the digital aids to his developments, what they can do for his occupiers, for his tenants, for his customers and so on. So, clearly it's the way it's going. I clearly need to know more about it as well, so that's probably all I need to say at the moment.
Paul?
I love technology. I'm a gadget man, and wherever we can use innovation... My team, on every scheme, have to give me one piece of innovation every time on a new development to tell me what we're going to do differently this time through progress, etc. And I love all that, because for me, it's all about making our purchasers, our customers' lives easier, their living easier. 10 years ago, what was the biggest bugbear when you bought a property? Waiting for BT to turn up. So what have we done now? I lose track of time, but all our developments now, fully wired, fully Wi-Fi'd. With HyperOptics, absolutely. Great partnership. And the feedback that we've had from people, the fact that when they turn up, they just suddenly are linked onto broadband because it's already done Fantastic, that's major progress.
And how about the Internet of Things and the impact on residential construction, which was James's question?
It's already playing a massive part in design, BIM, which is one of the design codes. We're effectively building up properties, it's come from commercial, but it's now in residential. And some of the things that used to get sorted out on site, basically, when you realise that you can't put a pipe where you want to put it because there's something in the way, technology is dealing with that all up front, and we're now getting better designed buildings. Sustainability is being brought into it. Absolutely agree. It's certainly lost its priority, but technology is helping with that at the design stage, and it's a massive, massive growth area.
Okay, thank you. And Nicola, Bristol's already a leading digital city. How might its further digitisation change the city?
Well, I believe reading this. Hang on, there is
Everyone's
something.
Everyone's brought notes.
Oh, yeah, hang on, there is something. I've now lost it. Thanks for that. We're doing a digital pilot, I believe. Does anyone know about this? Do you know about this, Paul? Yep, it's happening. Hang on a second. I've now lost it again. Sorry. We are doing something very relevant to this. Well, sorry, hang on. Here it is. Sorry. We are looking.
We may have to discuss it over a drink.
You can discuss it over a drink, that's fine, but we are doing something to do with a digital laboratory, apparently, in one of our housing developments. You'll have to ask Paul Smith.
Okay, well, we can talk about that.
Sorry, there we go.
We can talk about that over drinks. I'm sorry we didn't quite get through all the questions and the topic, but we had a very healthy debate in the middle there, which I hope we all enjoyed. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for your questions. Thank you to our sponsors. And if you are interested in that tech event we're running or any others, then let me know. But please do thank our panel.